This is the Create Your Own Life Show, episode 770 with General David Petraeus.
Fear is a technique of leadership. It's just not one that I think is the most successful. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind, by the way, that you know those who are actually in the fight, in the brotherhood of the close fight, as we term it,
sure.
That in that moment, in that world, where they're really fighting in a sense for their lives, if you will, what keeps someone fighting is not just self-preservation, it's also a fierce desire not to let down those on their right and left. That's really what it's about. This is no longer about motherhood and apple pie, the American flag, the Constitution. It's just about, again, not wanting to let your buddy down. And it's a very fierce desire by those who are really in the toughest of those fights.
This is the Create Your Own Life Show, where we interview people that are world-class performers, from Super Bowl champions to New York Times bestsellers to billionaires. We figure out what makes them tick and unpack it for you to do the same. I'm Jeremy Ryan Slate, and every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, we help you to create your own life. Hey, what is up, everybody? Jeremy here. It is the 16th of September, 2020, and this is the Create Your Own Life Show. I've got to tell you guys, I'm very excited for this episode because this may actually be, I guess, the most well-known guest we've ever had on the show, and somebody that I actually connected to on LinkedIn, which really surprised me because I didn't think he was going to be active on social media because he's achieved a lot, he's done a lot, and he works in very, very high circles. So it was exciting to me to get a chance to actually connect with him on LinkedIn. And I said, sir, I'd love to have you on the podcast. And this is back last year. He said, you know, there's a lot going on right now, but definitely check back. Would like to make it happen. And just a couple weeks ago, followed up and we were able to set a date and get this interview set up. So our guest today is 4-star general, retired, and former CIA director, General David Petraeus. And this is a really, really interesting one. If you guys aren't familiar with General Petraeus, he was the director of the Central Intelligence Agency from September 2011 to November 2012. He also served 37 years in the U.S. Army. Looking at some of his assignments, he was International Security Force and commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan from 2010 to 2011. His other 4-star assignments include the 10th Commander of U.S. Central Command from October 2008 to June 2010. He was also the commander of the coalition forces in Iraq from February 2007 to September 2008. In addition to that, he also teaching and now currently as well working with KKR, which is an investment company doing a lot of really big global investments where he is the chairman for their international division now. So we get into a lot of really, really interesting things here. The first being about leadership at that level, because here's the thing I want you guys to understand, right? Like to get to that level, whether it's in government or whether it's in military, you have to have a very unique, not only leadership style, but also ability to deal with people and personalities. Because no, not that I've been there, but you know, I do watch the news and stuff like that once in a while. You know, it seems like there's a lot of big egos the higher up you climb. So to be able to handle all those people well, and also continue to climb and continue to make things happen, you have to have a very unique ability to lead and a unique ability to work with others. So one of the things that surprised me about what General Petraeus and I talked about today is his ability to individualize his leadership style. And what I mean by that is not having an overarching idea on how to lead, but actually looking at what each individual person needs in order to be led. It was very interesting in that way. And we also take a look at the importance of having somebody close to you that can say to you what needs to be said. And for General Petraeus, that was when he was in Iraq, that was his translator that would be able to tug on his sleeve or poke him in the arm or whatever when he was kind of going just a little bit too far and, you know, verging on what wouldn't really be diplomatic anymore. So this is a really interesting episode. If you're somebody that is looking to be at the highest level of leadership, if you are somebody that has really big dreams and aspirations and looking to make them a reality, or if you're just somebody like me that really enjoys talking to people from the military, though, you know, I have never been myself because I just find their ability to lead and their ability to outwork others to be pretty incredible. So before we get into this interview with General Petraeus, though, I just want to quickly thank our sponsors. This episode is sponsored by Audible, and Audible is offering all of you kind people out there a free month of their service and a free audiobook. Right now, I am just finishing up War of the Gods by Eric von Däniken. You can get that book or any other book for free, courtesy of Audible, just heading over to jeremyryanslate.com/book. That is jeremyryanslate.com/book. Also, as you know, I have a mission to help a lot of people, and you can actually help me do that by subscribing, rating, and reviewing this show. So pull out your phone right now, find us in Apple Podcasts or Spotify, wherever you listen, hit that number of stars, leave us a review, and I will read that review on the air, or you can head over to ratethispodcast.com/CYOL. Today's review comes from Daniel E. Bauer. Live your best life. I love Jeremy's empowering message. He has a wonderful interview style and makes big time contribution to each episode he puts out here for us. A lot of us are waiting for the right moment, the right opportunity, or the right person to give us permission. Forget that. Jeremy has encouraged me to choose myself right now and get out there. I can create my ideal life today. I have everything I need to be a success. Thank you for the motivation, Jeremy. Thank you so much, Daniel E. Bauer. If you want to hear your review read on the air, head over to Apple Podcasts or Spotify, wherever you listen, or go over to ratethispodcast.com/CYOL. All right, without further ado, let's get into this interview with General David Petraeus. Hey, what is up, everybody? Jeremy here, and I am honored for the guest we have with us today. He spent 37 years serving this country, rising to the rank of 4-star general, serving as the commander of U.S. Central Command, also commanding general of the coalition forces in Iraq. After retiring from the military in 2011, he served as the director of the Central Intelligence Agency until November of 2012. He currently serves as the chairman of KKR Global Institute. Welcome to the Create Your Own Life show, General David Petraeus.
Great to be with you, Jeremy. Thanks.
Absolutely. General, I'm absolutely honored that you spent some time with myself and my audience today. And I always love getting to chat with people in the military because I do feel like, you know, military guys are a different breed. It really is. And I'm just, you know, honored you spent some time with us today.
Again, great to be with you.
Absolutely. So, General, you made the decision not only go to West Point and be a career soldier, but also, you know, you accepted serving your country in the CIA, I guess. What made you commit to continuing to serve your country, and how did that commitment evolve over time for you?
Well, as you get into a career in uniform, you discover certain elements, and if you enjoy those, if you feel challenged by them, if you have opportunities that are fulfilling, if you have chances to go between different activities, as I was privileged to do, say, an infantry company commander, one day under a rucksack, literally, and Kevlar helmet, and then going to graduate school at Princeton a couple of years later, teaching at West Point, then back to a unit in the great 101st Airborne Division, and so forth. And so back and forth between positions that call for real physical stamina and ability, for real, you know, enormous leadership opportunities at a fairly young age, or leading a platoon as a second lieutenant of some 43 or 44 paratroopers in Vicenza, Italy, as an example, as I was privileged to do. And just the whole notion of performing a mission that is larger than self, but again, one in the performance of which you are going from the field to occasionally Washington, although never during my general officer time, I guess, thankfully. And again, just the extraordinary privilege, the opportunity to serve with fellow Americans, particularly, frankly, in the wake of the 9/11 attacks and in the wars of the post-9/11 period, where Americans have raised their right hand and taken an oath to serve in uniform, knowing that they're going to deploy to combat and likely going to do it again and again, and in some cases, again and again after that. And so it was really, again, something that was beyond special. There is no greater privilege than that kind of service, to serve a mission that's larger than self, to do it with others who feel the same way, and to do it at a time, frankly, when Americans, even if they disagreed with the policies we were implementing, at least supported our young men and women in uniform and their families. And at the end of my time in uniform, President Obama gave me the opportunity to continue to serve our country, to continue, frankly, to stay, in a sense, in the fight against those who had brought 9/11 to us back in 2001. And again, that was also an extraordinary privilege and an opportunity. And frankly, I've been very fortunate since leaving government to have now been with KKR, one of the great investment firms of the world, for well over 7 years, to be a partner in that organization and the chairman of the KKR Global Institute, which examines the geopolitical risk as we are examining various investment opportunities around the world, and then integrates that with the macroeconomic analysis and the analysis of environmental, social, and governance issues, so that we are as smart an investor as we possibly can be. And then once we've made investments, we also help those companies that we own. We have 100 or so that we actually own fully, and then probably in minority investments in another 75 or so, and certainly spend a lot of time with our major investors, helping them understand the world in which we're all investing together. It's very intellectually stimulating. It's very rewarding. I also still have the opportunity to do speaking and to support nonprofits, including a dozen or so veterans organizations, and even to be a private venture capitalist to invest in some 17 or so startups since leaving government.
Well, I guess looking at it then, you mentioned, you know, it being intellectually stimulating, and you've served a lot of different roles, including, you know, being at Princeton and things. You've written a lot. And I guess looking at all the writing you've done, I guess what role has that played for you? You know, I guess not just in your career, but also as like an intellectual outlet.
Well, I think writing, as someone famously observed, helps you distill your thoughts. It forces you actually to distill the ideas. It's an action forcing mechanism, the commitment to write, as we did the counterinsurgency field manual, and to publish that in less than a year during the time that I was back in the United States between my 3- and 4-star tours in Iraq, for example. It was a huge intellectual journey for all of us who were engaged in it. It provided the intellectual foundation on which we built the strategy, the big ideas of the surge, which of course were about 180-degree shift from what we've been doing before. But all along, it was always, even if it was an article about physical training, it just sort of forces you to truly sit down and to lay out your thinking and to do it obviously as coherently and concisely and effectively as you possibly can. It's often been that I get an idea while running or in the shower, you name it, that one of those kinds of occasions, and it seems crystal clear to you at that time. And then when you try to write it down and to lay it out and to develop it, it actually turns out that it wasn't quite so crystal clear. And it's the action of trying to lay that out in writing that forces you to do that. And I'm a big believer actually in what might be termed action forcing mechanisms. I mean, there's nothing as productive as setting a deadline for yourself and committing to it publicly to others, whether it is that you're going to run a marathon in, you know, 2 hours and 50 minutes, or you're going to do a PhD and have all the work done except for the dissertation itself by the time you leave grad school after just 2 years. So it's these kinds of, again, exercises that I've found very, very meaningful. They have forced me, again, to sit down and to, as clearly as I could, lay out the various ideas that I had on various issues. And it still is the case, you know, to commit to an op-ed piece for, say, the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post on, you know, what should we have learned from the last 20 years of war against Islamist extremists, these kinds of issues. It's a very intellectually challenging and often, again, fulfilling endeavor.
Well, I can appreciate that. It's been a number of years now since I did my master's thesis on Roman emperor worship, but it really kind of makes you look at things a different way and figure out, do these narratives fit together? Do these ideas fit together? Maybe our thinking is incorrect on it. So I think it definitely makes us work a lot of those things out before we put them into the real world.
Well, it also provides you intellectual capital on which you draw later on. And I'm also a believer that senior theses, various monographs, dissertations, whatever it is that we end up producing over the years, ideally are on topics that do provide intellectual capital for the future. So when I did my dissertation on the American military and the lessons of Vietnam, it was a tremendously instructive project for me, if for nobody else. Again, right. I think we overrate probably how important or impactful or significant as something like a dissertation can be, but it certainly is significant for the person who is doing the research and the writing and analysis and so forth. And years later, when all of a sudden I was the individual providing advice on the use of force, I would reflect back on those situations and examples and historical cases that I had examined in the post-Vietnam era when force was considered and what the character of the advice was, how it was provided, and all the rest of that. And it was very, very helpful, actually. Again, many years later, it was even helpful when I was the executive officer for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for 2 years when I was a colonel. And I remember walking in and saying, you know, boss, historically, no president has ever decided to use force when a chairman of the Joint Chiefs opposed it. Mm. So just think about the significance of what it is that your advice holds in one of these meetings in the Situation Room at the West Wing of the White House.
Well, General, in part of my preparation for our conversation, I was talking to my friend, Major General Greg Sturdivant, about, like, you know, maybe some of the things we should chat about. And General Sturdivant mentioned that he said, beginning at the rank of colonel, the biggest challenge that you face with people is dealing with individual personalities. And I'm curious, did you find that to be true? And if so, how did that impact your role as the lead for the coalition forces?
Oh, look, I think you're dealing with personalities and egos from the time that you're a second lieutenant, if you're a commissioned officer, or a buck sergeant, if you're a non-commissioned officer. You know, you're always dealing with individuals. And one of my views, in fact, is that your leadership style shouldn't be something that's fixed and inviolate. It actually should be whatever is required to bring out the best in each of those. You're privileged to lead individually. In other words, your direct reports, each of them. And it will be different for each of them. Some might need a pat on the back once a year. Others might need it once an hour.
Right.
Still, others might need an application of boot in some part of the anatomy. But so, again, I think you're always doing with that. Now, obviously, the more senior you get, frankly, the more senior and in some cases inflated egos you're dealing with, the more special people think that they are, the more delicate sometimes it might be dealing with them. And when you get to very senior ranks, obviously you're dealing with people who have been very successful, but you still have to lead them. It's not a case of imposing your will on them. It's a case of persuading them, convincing them, getting them to support wholeheartedly and willingly, and to contribute. And to, if that person thinks that you're off base, to explain where that might be and why, and lay out the analysis for that. And then obviously coalition leadership, you have a whole new batch of folks who are very sensitive about national identities and anything that could be implied as criticism. And then, you know, you have host nation partners, the prime minister of Iraq or the president of Afghanistan, and not to mention our own political leaders who are not without egos either. And they're all different. Some manage to suppress it pretty effectively. Others, it's on display a bit more prominently. But regardless of the case, again, you've got to understand the personality traits, the strengths, the weaknesses, the susceptibility to flattery, I mean, all of these different elements that make up a person's identity. And of course, I have the same.
Sure.
You know, I would try to be a person of small ego, but wasn't always successful. And frankly, if you are at very senior levels and you do encounter a degree of success, it becomes harder to suppress that, certainly. I was very fortunate, though, to work for a boss early on when he was still a two-star general, Major General Jack Galvin. I was his aide as a captain when he was a division commander. And he was really quite famous for being understated and being low maintenance, as he put it, and really trying to have his aide focus on the substantive aspects of the job rather than, you know, bringing over a perfectly mixed martini with one or two olives or something like that at the blink of an eye or when there was a certain signal given. He said, look, just send the waiter over to me. You know, I'll get a drink. Don't worry. You sort out what's going on and talk to your fellow aides and figure out what's happening behind the scenes. Figure out what's going on in the units that you and I haven't actually laid eyes on. It was all those kinds of issues. He wanted me to expand his impact, not to be his, again, cigarette lighter. And he continued that. I worked for him twice more, twice, in fact, when he was a four-star general, culminating with him being the NATO Supreme Allied Commander of Europe. And he still had a very small ego. I mean, he did things that I actually couldn't bring myself to do. He would wear only two rows of ribbons, for example. Frankly, I let mine continue to expand as I got them, at least to a certain point where you just sort of run out of room and you realize, okay, what's this all about anyway? But again, he was a man of tremendous modesty and was on receive, not on transmit. And again, it was a very admirable example. By the way, he was also a soldier scholar. He'd written 3 books by the time I worked for him. He wrote one more. I helped with the final book that he wrote. In fact, delivered the eulogy at his funeral at Arlington Cemetery. And again, he was a statesman as well. And when you ask who is it you wanted to be like, he would certainly be in the front rank of those that I was privileged to see up close and personal. And there are certainly many others who had various attributes and strengths and capabilities that you also try to develop in yourself. But again, the Army is somewhat unique. The military is somewhat unique, certainly the ground services in particular, because you have this mix of need for a fairly substantial physical dimension, especially in the infantry, but also, you know, this is very complicated stuff. Yeah. This is a technical field. You really do have to understand how to employ all these different weapon systems and fuse types and how you orchestrate all of this. This is not simple stuff. It is a profession by the definition of those who have, you know, in other words, a special body of knowledge and a professional ethos. Mm-hmm. And you spend years and years and years, decades, trying to master that profession in the hope that should there be a need to employ those capabilities, that you are ready to do that. And, you know, most of us go through our career and you don't have that opportunity. Even you may be ready, but it just doesn't come. Not that you're wishing for it, because I really don't believe that the military are wanting to have war so that they can demonstrate their ability as leaders or something like that. That is not the case. I mean, those who have seen war and know the real cost and sacrifice that is entailed in combat are not keen to see this either continue or expand or embark on new wars. But we also recognize that the way to prevent war, to deter conflict, is obviously by having both capabilities and the will to use those.
I want to quickly tell you about today's sponsor. This episode is sponsored by Gusto, and this is actually the payroll management system that we use at my company, Command Your Brand. We've used them for years, absolutely love them, and they offer modern, easy payroll, benefits, and HR service to small business across the country. They were even named Best Online Payroll by PC Mag, and as a listener, you'll actually get $100 free just for trying the service via an Amazon gift card if you just head over to jeremyryanslate.com/gusto and get your free trial. As I said, we have used Gusto at Command Your Brand to run all of our payroll, handle all of our taxes, all of that filing, and it makes it just a snap. We absolutely love them. So if you want to get started with Gusto and get a $100 Amazon gift card just for getting started, head over to jeremyryanslate.com/gusto and get started with Gusto today. Well, I guess like talking about that level of leadership then, General, I think it's really interesting because it seems like there's so much of like required intellectual capacity at that, because you are like you having all these skills, all this knowledge, but also playing chess at a high level as well to kind of make all this stuff work. And I guess like looking at that level of leadership, like our military's turned out some incredible leaders, and, you know, including presidents like, you know, U.S. Grant, Eisenhower. And I guess like looking at it, what do you think makes military leadership different than private sector leadership?
Well, first of all, I'd just submit, having now been in the private sector for well over seven years, that the private sector has some extraordinary leaders as well. And ones on whom I focus the most are those that have exercised strategic leadership. So these are the individuals who really founded a company or are leading a company at a very high level, or, as in the case of a Jeff Bezos, have literally built the entire company and continue to still lead it. And strategic leaders have to get 4 tasks right, whether they are in uniform or, again, the CEO of Amazon or Netflix or you name it, Alibaba. These are all Jack Ma, in fact, another one of the great strategic leaders of all time, not just of his generation, I think. And it's the same for the most senior leaders in the military, the commander of, say, forces in Iraq or Afghanistan or some of the other very senior organizations in our military ranks. And as a strategic leader, you've got to get the big ideas right. You have to get the strategy right. And that's not always all that easy. And the fact is that prior to the surge in Iraq, we weren't making progress because we didn't have the right strategy. We had it. and it became invalidated, and it was very difficult to change it. And it took, obviously, changing the Secretary of Defense and some other key people for us to do that, including the commander, what came to be known as the surge. So you got to get the big ideas right. You then have to communicate them throughout the breadth and depth of the organization. You have to oversee their implementation. You have to drive the campaign. This is what we normally think of as leadership. This is someone providing the example, the energy, the sheer will, the determination. It's how the leader spends his or her time. It's the metrics to tell you whether you're winning or losing, making progress or falling behind. It's hiring and firing. It's promoting those who deserve it. It's allowing those to leave who shouldn't continue. It's all of that kind of activity, which again, we normally associate with. It's the tactics, techniques, and procedures of leadership. And then there's a fourth task that is often overlooked at a company or leader's peril, which is to determine how to refine the big ideas so that you can do it again and again and again. And the great leaders, whether in uniform or in the private sector, have invariably performed those four tasks right. And most importantly of all, really, the absolute most important is to get the big ideas right. And that's this element, this intangible, it's judgment, it's strategic judgment. It's, again, knowing whether you should turn right or left, it's go straight, or to invest more here and to fold up that, and all of these kinds of very fundamental decisions on the direction of an enterprise. That's really the essence of leadership. Because if you don't get those right, I don't care how eloquent you are, what a great communicator you may be, how inspirational, I don't know, energetic, driven, hardworking, focused, all these other capabilities that are so important. But if you didn't get the big ideas right in the first place, everything else is building on a shaky intellectual foundation. So that is really crucial. And if you look at those who have been the most important leaders over the years, whose contributions have meant the most at critical times, you find those that got the big ideas right and then had the other qualities to perform the other tasks, again, of strategic leadership as I've laid out. And for what it's worth, I sent to you actually the website at Harvard's Belfer Center that we built when I was a fellow there for 6 years on strategic leadership that lays all of this out and then illustrates it with the surge in Iraq. Also illustrates it with Netflix, with Reed Hastings and how he has reinvented Netflix several times over the years.
They went from, you know, DVDs being mailed to your house. And then, you know, once that model and Blockbuster and everything else was done, they reinvented the business. And I think that's vital to have that vision big enough to survive, you know, changes in whether it's changes in, you know, the government that's in or changes in the business world. Like, you have to be able to go your big ideas past those.
Always. And you have to adapt to changing circumstances, and context does change. Mm-hmm. By the way, when you succeed in something or when you make progress in some endeavor, that actually changes the context in which you are engaged. And you have to adjust the big ideas to actually accommodate a degree of success, if you will. Mm-hmm. And then to build on that, how do you capitalize on that? What do you do next? And that's that process of determining how to refine the big ideas and doing it again and again and again.
Well, General, I guess, like, looking at it, whether it's, you know, being actually in government or being in the military, like, one of the really important things to have is to be diplomatic and be able to, you know, use diplomacy in the right way. And I guess when you're looking at it for yourself, how have you balanced diplomacy with your own personal integrity? And has that approach changed over the years?
Well, look, I don't think that you can start making choices between the two of those. That doesn't mean that you need to, you know, barge in on the Prime Minister of Iraq and tell him that this latest idea he's had is a truly miserable one and you're not going to help him implement it. And oh, by the way, if he does try to implement it, you will withdraw the resources for its execution. There are subtler ways than that. We used to say that, look, we're going to go in today and this is going to be a really tough meeting, again, with a host nation partner, again, perhaps a prime minister or a president. And I'm going to act, and I'm going to act very angry at some point. As we used to say, I'm going to demonstrate the full range of emotions. I'm going to be exercised. And I said, it's okay as long as you don't think that I'm losing it. In other words, as long as I'm still acting, as long as you think I've still got it under control, just let it go. But if you think I'm actually getting angry, because again, some of these are really deadly serious, as in lives of soldiers and civilians and so forth, issues and extraordinary cost. And you can get worked up. You should. I mean, any leader worth his or her salt should get worked up over some of these issues. But you've got to restrain yourself. And I said, if you think I am no longer acting, to my longtime translator, Saadi Othman, who was with me for all 4 years that I was in Iraq, went back every time and then on after that, they say, pluck my sleeve, because he would literally sit between me and the prime minister in Iraq, because that's where the translator would position him or herself. And once or twice, he plucked my sleeve, and I realized, wow, I was on the verge of doing something that might have been what we term non-biodegradable, i.e. it never goes away. Having once said this, your relationship is irrevocably changed, and you don't want to do that. This isn't about being, quote, political or, I don't know, diplomatic just because it's something nice to do, although I do believe that we should treat others the way we would like to be treated. I do think that we should assume that individuals want to be all that they can be, to be the best that they can be until they prove otherwise. Again, there's a certain number of principles, I think, that should govern how we deal with others and how we treat them and how we provide them respect and so forth. And even, frankly, in firing people, I wasn't one who believed in what the military sometimes termed public executions. Now, this isn't going out and, you know, shooting somebody. This is actually publicly, so you're fired, you're out of here, and you make it known. Or even if it was a private personnel decision, that you make it known that this individual was fired, unless it was truly obvious that something had been done that was so egregious that required that, then for good order and discipline, the force needs to know that that was done. But in most cases, when you're at the levels at which I was operating in my final 10 years in uniform and then at the CIA, you're dealing with people who have enormous capabilities. But there is a certain point for some of them where they do indeed validate the so-called Peter Principle concept, where they're promoted one level above their level of competence. And if that's the case, particularly in combat, you can't carry somebody just because he or she has another 6 months until the rotation date. Mm-hmm. You owe it to those who are putting their lives on the line every day to get someone in there who is competent. But it doesn't mean that you have to destroy the individual personally, that you have to personally, publicly execute that person in sending that individual home. Again, depending on the level of relative lack of, again, mastery at that level. Sometimes, you know, I'd call the service chief back in Washington and say this individual is his or her potential. Sometimes it might be that the individual just shouldn't lead again. Sometimes no more promotions, perhaps no more service. But again, you can allow a person to retain his or her sort of dignity and respect. And I think it's the right thing to do just from, you know, treating a fellow human being as well as you can, unless there's an obvious reason for not doing so.
I think it's funny you talk about the idea of public executions. If we go, you know, thousands of years ago now, when people always say, oh, we got decimated, I hate when they use that term, because the original term decimation comes from Roman generals killing every 10th man, kind of keep guys in line. Not the best way to make people want to follow you or want to lead you when you are, I guess, you know, in this case, embarrassing people that way. Like, it's just not the way to endear people to yourself.
Well, I mean, fear is a technique of leadership. It's just not one that I think is the most successful. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind, by the way, that, you know, those who are actually in the fight, in the brotherhood of the close fight, as we term it, sure, and that includes women as well as men and has throughout the post 9/11 wars, that in that moment, in that world where they're really fighting in a sense for their lives, if you will, what keeps someone fighting is not just self-preservation, it's also a fierce desire not to let down those on their right and left. That's really what it's about. This is no longer about motherhood and apple pie, the American flag, the Constitution. It's just about, again, not wanting to let your buddy down. And it's a very fierce desire by those who are really in the toughest of those fights. And that's why it is termed the brotherhood of the close fight. It's, you know, the most extraordinary fraternity, if you will, that is out there. And that's what keeps them going. And what keeps them re-enlisting is, again, sense of privilege to perform a mission larger than self, to do it with others who feel the same way, and again, to do it at a time when Americans, by and large, are supportive of those who are in uniform, again, even if they may disagree with the policies that we are executing.
Absolutely. Well, General, I know we're running a little low on time here, but I have just a couple questions for you left here. And sure. And I guess, like, looking at your current role at KKR, how has that helped you grow in new areas of your life? Because it is in the civilian world, it is a little bit different, but you're still dealing with a lot of, you know, high-level international situations. So how has that helped you grow in new areas of your life?
Well, obviously, what you're focusing on is not now necessarily the national security interest. You're focusing on the interests of a global investment firm and those whose financial resources we are investing for them. And it is a very different world in some respects, and it's a very similar world in others. Obviously, mm-hmm. the geopolitical risks that we assess for investment purposes are the same risks that in many cases can influence national security. So, you know, I'm no longer assessing those for the national security team and the president. I'm doing it for, again, the leaders of this enormous, again, and very successful global firm who are trying to gauge whether or not we should invest in a firm and whether by providing them additional resources and expertise, which is the real secret sauce, if you will, or the ingredient that we'd like to think differentiates what we provide from some of the others, is that going to help them grow? Will it enable them to build greater value, to provide more opportunity for their workers, to expand what it is they're doing and all the rest of that? That's the idea. So again, there are certainly differences. I mean, the whole world of private investment in particular, rather than public equity, is somewhat unique. And I've learned a fair amount about the financial side of the investment world, noting that, you know, I do have a PhD in a combination of international relations and economics, and I did actually mm-hmm. teach economics, but this is not just economic analysis. So we have a team that does the macroeconomic analysis for any of the deals that we're examining where that is relevant, which is most of them. But this is about financial expertise and how do you structure a deal so that, again, we can really help them. And of course, we're obviously out to help our investors and ourselves at the end of the day. And it's the incentive structure that is built into capitalist economics, market economics and free markets and competition and all the rest of that, that are really what are the spark that ignites a lot of the growth that we see around the world.
Well, General, I guess, like, looking at yourself at 21, so I guess, you know, you were probably in West Point at that point in time, but I guess looking at yourself at 21 versus now, what's something you believed at 21 that you do not believe now?
Gosh, I don't know that there is anything that I don't believe now that I believed in at 21. I mean, I believed in hard work, that hard work can improve your chances of success, that focus, that trying to be, again, obviously the best you can be, that life is a competitive endeavor, you know, embrace it. You don't get a t-shirt just for showing up in the real world, that you have to, that success can enable future opportunities. I really did believe from a very, you know, early time in uniform that luck is what happens when preparation meets opportunity. And I was determined to be as prepared as I could be if there was a call for that preparation at some time. It is fair for people to look at my career and say, well, gosh, you know, Petraeus got lucky here or there. And there is truth in that. There's a number of times along in my career where something happened that was just timing, luck, what have you.
But you have to keep like showing to up and that, working hard in order to get lucky, right?
Yeah. I mean, again, you make your luck sometimes as well. And as I said, luck is what happens when preparation meets opportunity. And so if the opportunity presents itself, can you capitalize? Can you make the most of it? And, you know, toward the end where president turns to you and says, we need you to lead an effort to try to turn around a situation that's pretty desperate in Iraq. You know, on the one hand, you'd like to think that your life's effort to prepare for this has equipped you with what is necessary. But at the end of the day, it's always a little bit of self-doubt as well. And there should be. I mean, you should never certainly get smug or anything like that, or overconfident, needless to say. And in fact, I used to gather individuals around me who would be, we used to call them the iconoclasts or the, I mean, there was one individual who had criticized the general officers in the Army as a lieutenant colonel in an article, which had some disparaging comments about our intellectual capabilities. And some of the points probably were valid. And so the institution tried to prevent him from actually deploying with the unit that he commanded, an artillery battalion.
Wow.
And so they carefully structured a deployment order that called for all of the different elements, but not for him.
Wow.
And so I set up a request for forces that called for an individual and a handful of staff that would precisely fit him and only him, and got him deployed over and put him in the organization that was overseeing his forces. But in part because that's, you want those kinds of it. Now, there are some that just endlessly intellectual bomb chuckers, as you say, just to see what happens with the detonation. And that's not quite as constructive as someone that is willing to say, excuse me, but, you know, have you thought about this? And the response shouldn't be to take great umbrage and say, who are you to question the four-star commander of the multinational force Iraq? Rather, you should say, well, let me think about that. And actually, great debate is good as well. That's what, in the process of developing the big ideas, and also in that important step of determining how to refine them, you want to have as inclusive process, as transparent and open as you can, because you want people to be bubbling up ideas that will help you shape the refined big ideas. Because no one of us is smarter than all of us together. Mm-hmm. And I've never been one who can find the right tree to sit under and get hit on the head by Newton's apple fully formed. I get hit on the head by a seed of an idea or a kernel, and then you have to build it into a big idea. And you do that, again, by a process that is, at least in my case, it's often quite iterative, and it is inclusive. And, you know, even if you actually thought you were the brightest person in the room or the world or the organization and brighter than all the rest of them together, you'd still want them involved, because you want them to have a sense that they contributed and that they were inside the tent, again, contributing their thoughts and criticisms in some cases, rather than being outside the tent, because you know what people do who are excluded, they're outside the tent. So again, just as a leadership practice, beyond actually being what I would argue is the right approach to take, having an inclusive, open, transparent process that actually welcomes reasoned dissent. Again, not just endless bomb chucking and questioning, but reasoned, thoughtful contribution. You know, H.R. McMaster, who was famous as a captain for having written a book about the senior military leadership during Vietnam, it was titled Dereliction of Duty.
Wow.
That is the kind of individual you want. And it was occasionally said that, you know, H.R., it's every now and then you might want to leave something left unsaid.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not his way. Valued that. We brought him over during the surge. He was actually, quote, assigned to the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in that 19 and a half month period that I was the commander of the surge in Iraq, I was the one writing his efficiency reports because we had him down in Iraq so much and we valued him so highly. When I went to Afghanistan on very short notice, the first person I asked for was by then Brigadier General H.R. McMaster, having actually sat on the promotion board, been the president of the promotion board that just happened to pick him for Brigadier General. So that's what the kind of person you want. The institution doesn't always recognize the value, and it can sometimes question or even disparage the value of some of those more cerebral and critical thinkers, but that's what an institution does need. And you need to preserve and protect those that are the most constructive in their thoughtful and, again, reasoned input, which sometimes includes criticism.
Well, General, this has been awesome today. I just so appreciate your time. For people listening to this, if they want to follow more of what you're doing, you know, where should be the best place for them to go?
The only social media in which I'm active at all is actually LinkedIn. And I do comment on a variety of pieces on there, and I do contribute pieces from time to time as well. So, And if you send me a proper link or write-up or photo or whatever else it is, I'll post this on LinkedIn. But that's the extent of my social media activity. And that's the best place probably to follow along.
Very cool. Well, General David Petraeus, thank you so much for joining me today on the Create Your Own Life show.
My pleasure. Thanks very much, Jeremy.
Hey, everyone. Thank you for hanging out with me and General Petraeus today. Hope you really enjoyed this one. This is a really cool and interesting one for me. You can follow him over on LinkedIn is where he's posting and he's the most active. You can get the show notes for this episode over at jeremyryanslate.com/770. Also, do not forget, you guys can help me to help more people by subscribing, rating, and reviewing the show. And you can do that over an Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or LG Listen, or by simply going to ratethispodcast.com/CYOL. All right, everyone. Thank you so much for hanging out today. Have an amazing, amazing day. Now get out there and go create your own life.